Major announcement today from the USGA and RNA, which could profoundly impact the game going forward. How the new proposed model local rule rolling back the ball starting in 2026. Some potentially major changes which could change the highest levels in the game. We're going to break it all down along with reaction from across the golf world in a jam-packed Tuesday show as Golf Today starts right now.
Golf Today.
Let's get right to it. The USGA RNA proposing a model local rule that gives competition organizers the option to require use of golf balls that are tested under modified launch conditions to address the impacts of hitting distance in golf. The model local rule is intended for use only in elite competitions and, if adopted, will have no impact on recreational golf. So with that, hello and welcome into our Golf Channel studios. I'm George Savarikas alongside Golf Week columnist Eamon Lynch, and this is a two-hour edition of Golf Today. Eamon, we have so much to get to, and there'll be a lot of ripple effects felt around the golf world. Let's get to more of the details in this proposal so the viewer at home is up to speed. This is the distance proposal, the USGA and RNA proposed model local rule requiring use of golf balls tested under modified launch conditions to address hitting distance. Model local rule only intended for use in elite competitions. We're going to have to get that specific definition coming up, which would be available starting in 2026. Conforming golf balls under the model local rule must not exceed overall distance standard limit, 317 yards at 127 mile per hour clubhead speed. So what is the definition here for this model local rule? A modification of a rule or an additional rule a committee adopts for a competition, that's the definition of model local rule, has same status as a rule of golf for that competition, covers situation or issues that arise often enough to justify having a model form. This all part of the distance Insights project between the USGA and RNA that was launched back in May of 2018 to study the impact of hitting distance in golf. February 2020. Remember, the Distance Insights report was released. It detailed hitting distance trends in golf. A year later, February 2021, specific areas of interest, proposed equipment rules, changes that were issued regarding distance. Then the spring of last year, March of 22, updated areas of interest released on hitting distance in golf. And now, the model local rule proposed for golf balls in elite competitions. Time now to welcome in our guest to the show. That's USGA CEO Mike Wann, along with RNA Chief Executive Martin Slumbers. Guys, this question to both of you. Martin, would like to start with you. How did you settle on the golf ball as the area of emphasis?
So, I mean, it's quite interesting looking at your slide that you're just putting there, how many years we've been working on this this topic. But you'll recall back in March of 22, we published an area of interest that said we were interested in two topics. One was a ball for the whole game that had a different overall distance standard. And secondly, was a model local rule on the driver, which would have reduced forgiveness across the face of the driver. Over the last 6 months, we've had a lot of comment, a lot of collaboration, a lot of discussion, and a lot of work between Mike's and my teams and Mike and I together. We heard three pieces of feedback. One was, please do not do anything to affect the recreational game. The golf's doing well, and we don't want to undermine this. Secondly, we heard that an MLR on the driver would impact multiple clubs, and you couldn't result in the unintended consequences of a 3-wood or a 5-wood being more having higher performance than a driver. And thirdly, we heard too much change proposed, guys, is too complex. And so we listened to that very carefully. We considered it in the context of all the data analysis we had. We considered it in the context of we are focused on the future of the game and where the game is going and the integrity. And we wanted to make sure that we were targeted and we were proportionate in our proposal. And so as we went through that, we decided that we were going to focus on the ball and we were going to focus on elite amateur golf so that there is no impact on the general recreational game. And this is all about elite golf.
Mike, let me address a question to you about these testing parameters that you've introduced. The average club head speed on the PGA Tour is right around 114 miles an hour. The testing speed you're going to use is 127 miles an hour, which presumably looks toward what you believe the trends are going. How did you arrive at that number of 127 miles an hour club head speed for testing?
Yeah, thanks, Eamon. You know, this goes back a lot farther than today's announcement. You know, we started this in 76 and then in 86. And back then we used 109, which represented at the time what we thought were the club head speeds being represented at the highest level and the longest hitters of the game. In 2002 and 2004, we updated that test from 109 mile an hour club head speed to 120, which at the time represented the top 1% of hitting speed. So we've never tried to set the test at where the average is. We've tried to assess where the longest hitting in the game is. And today, the longest hitters in the game are generating 127 mile an hour club head speed. And if you just, you know, if you just watch the last few years, not to mention the last few decades, it's pretty safe to say 127 will be reached by even more by the time we're talking about this implementation, if adopted in 2026. So every time we've done one of these tests, whether it was 76, 86, 2002, 2004, and every time we announce one of those changes, we announce that we'll continue to relook at this test to make sure that our test represents and replicates the highest hitters of the game. So doing a test right now at 120 miles an hour when a significant amount of club head speed being generated on individual drives at elite levels, and people want to make this about PGA Tour or just the European Tour, we're talking about the highest levels of the game at all different levels. So 127 represents the speeds that we're seeing generated at those levels, Eamon. So we would actually make sure that the ball is addressing that. If we were to say 123, by the time we get to 2026, we'd already be talking about 125. So it's aligned with what we've done historically, and consistently tries to, when we reset these, address the highest level of the game.
Mike, with the health of the game right now, the boom that we've seen in golf post-COVID, why is now the time to enact this type of change?
Yeah, you're right, George. I mean, we feel the same way, which is the game is healthy, it's strong. The recreational game is at a level we've probably never seen before. And so when we, to Martin's point, this is a long, deliberate, and really transparent process. And you know me, George, long and patient probably isn't my strong suit. But this process has really forced us to keep telling people where we are every step of the way. And let's sit back and listen for a while. And this is the same as true of today. This is a notice and comment. Today we notify, and over the next four or five months, we listen to comments. But what I would tell you is one of the comments that we heard, and Martin referenced it, is please don't touch the recreational game if you can. It's really an exciting time, and we don't see recreational golf challenging or obsoleting venues in the long run. And so we tried to incorporate that in this change, where this doesn't affect the retail business for recreational players today. It doesn't affect the clubs and balls that are in your garage or in your trunk today. It enables the recreational game to continue as currently planned. At the same time, and George, I will tell you this, I think a lot of people want to have this argument about the game today. Martin and I's job is to make sure that we look at the game today and those trends and what they'll look like over the next 20 or 30 years. Very few people, and I know there are some, but very few people will argue, based on what you've seen in the last 40 years, that distance is going to continue to increase over the next 10, 20, and 40 years. I mean, there's virtually no data that would make you comfortably say that, although I've heard some sort of argue that. So given what's going on with speed training and youth and athleticism, we see increases continuing. And the real question is, 20, 25, 30 years from now, can the game sustain that kind of continued incremental growth? So that's why we haven't been in a rush to make this change. And that's why this change is really more about addressing the future and not about correcting anything today.
Martin, the modified local rule appears specifically aimed at elite men's golf. No one's suggesting that women hit the ball too far right now, even at the elite level of the game. What happens if the elite tours on which those competitions are held choose not to adopt the rule? Does that in any way diminish the governing bodies? Or how does that work politically if there is not the support among the tours that it's clearly aimed at?
I think the great advantage of the model local rule is that we're creating options for the game. We're creating choices. And, you know, during the development of this process, there's been a lot of collaboration with right across the game that Mike and I have done with our colleagues, and we will continue to do so to have this debate. And you know, I think when you look at where the model local rule will be applied, You know, I do think that it will come back into the elite amateur sport because, as Mike and I are trying to make very clear, we're really focused on the future. And when you look at the younger players coming through, the speed training that's going on, the more athleticism, the greater use of excellent technology, we're seeing that increase in speed moving up and will come into the pro ranks in the future. So, you know, I look long term. Ideally, we would like to see the model local rule being applied generically, but I'm taking a long-term view over this and right down into the depths of the top amateur game and through to the pro game. And, you know, from our point of view, it is clear that the Open and our top amateur events, we will be implementing it. So there will be a line in the sand will be put in there for us anyway.
Martin, part of the beauty of the game is that you can try and qualify for the Open or the U.S. Open, and you can have the same equipment that you use at your club and then try and play on the game's biggest stage. Would you say this model local rule in certain respects is a euphemism for bifurcation, which is something that the golf world has been reticent to adopt previously?
You know, this is my eighth year in this role, and, you know, I hadn't heard of that word when I came into this role. And I think it is a word that has been talked about quite a lot, and I can understand why as we try to keep the game. But really, I think we're moving, as the game is developing, particularly in the men's game, particularly in the elite game, when the quality of play is so distinct from the regular amateur, that really we've moved past the point where bifurcation is in any danger of undermining the recreational game. And I think what we're really focusing on in my own thinking is ensuring that we keep the integrity of the sport, the balance of skills at the top end, but also keep that balance of skills and the integrity in the recreational game and ensuring that we keep it thriving.
Mike, you mentioned how long
hey, George,
this process has been going on all the way back to the 1970s through the 80s. Sorry, Mike, did you wish to add to that?
Yeah, thanks, Eamon, for that opportunity. I just wanted to add on to Martin's comments, which is I've heard this argument a lot in the last hour, I guess, since we've released. And I think you know this, Eamon, but maybe the viewers don't. I mean, there's something in the neighborhood of 80 model local rules available today to competitions, 10 of which are club-related. Some are as recent as 46-inch driver or green reading materials. Some of them a little bit more, you know, whether it's distance devices. These are all rules that have been are opportunity for competitions to do things that are slightly different than the regular recreational game. So, if people are concerned that model local rules are bifurcation, unfortunately, we passed that bridge 30, 40 years ago. And some of those, by the way, model local rules aren't driven by the RNA and the USGA bringing those to. Some of those have tours and other competitions that come to us and said, help us manage green reading materials or help us manage, you know, one ball versus multiple ball rules. So model local rules, if for those elite amateurs that have played in one of our elite amateur events or have had the luck to make it to an Open or US Open, they've experienced model local rules and they've existed for a long time.
Earlier, Mike, you'd mentioned how long this process has been going on. You know, there have been certain benchmarks all the way back to the 1970s. If this model local rule has been introduced now, it would imply that there's a sense that there's a pressing need to act between the governing bodies. Is that not a tacit admission that your organisations have failed to this point in their responsibilities to do something before now?
Fair critique, Eamon. I mean, if that's what you want the headline to be, that we should have done this 10 years ago, I think Martin and I will both take that as a fair critique. I've said this many times, which is I'm open to any dialogue with anyone who loves this game about what the right choice is going forward. The only dialogue I haven't been real comfortable with is the person that looks me in the face and says, distance isn't getting any longer than it is today, because there's virtually no historical perspective, or they haven't been to a junior speed training clinic or been to a junior amateur to kind of see what's happening. So Do we have this exactly right? I don't know. A year ago, I thought we did, and we've made quite a bit of changes based on that feedback. I know we'll probably make some adaptations based on this next feedback period. But the only choice that I think is patently wrong at this stage is no choice, because I don't think anybody could argue with the fact that this game is going to be 20 or 30 yards longer in the next 20 or 25 years. And if that's the case, we're just handing the sustainability of this game to the next generation and the 30,000 golf courses around the world and telling them to just figure it out. And that's a responsibility that neither Martin and I are willing to shirk. And so there may be more learning on how we can actually do this in the exact right way. But we will definitely make sure that we don't leave the game for the next generation more challenged than the generation that's playing it today.
Mike, could you elaborate on the sustainability issues? If you say 20 to 30 year purview that you're looking at, how much additional real estate are we looking at with distance gains? Like, are you able to break it down from a monetary standpoint?
Well, listen, if you think about how long we've been working on this distance project, and again, I mean, I walked in maybe in the middle of it, but since 2018, these are long, deliberate, very transparent processes by design. So if we want to have real change in 2028, you know, we start working on 2018. So we can't, somebody's just said, well, why not just wait and see how much longer is in 10 years? Well, at that point, it's too late to kind of make significant change. I think with the kind of change we're talking about in this notice and comment, we'd probably see a 14 or so yard difference for the average elite male competition. And based on the way distance is going, that means 15 years from now, we're going to be right back where we are today. And we're okay with that. We're not trying to shut down distance forever. We're not trying to shut down athleticism. We want longer golfers to be longer than shorter golfers and be able to chase that advantage, just as we have in the past. And that's kind of where we are today. But we know that if 302 is the average elite male competition driver, becomes 322, becomes 342, we're asking golf courses to change. We're asking golf courses to find more property. We're asking golf courses to have more water, more nutrients, in a time in which, not in all parts of the country, but in a lot of parts of the world, just being bigger and having more cost and having that cost just get passed back to the golfer is a tough ask in a lot of parts of the world, especially parts of the world where water and nutrients aren't as plentiful as some of the others. So I think it would be irresponsible for us to see what we see coming and simply say, well, we'll leave it for the next generation. And to Eamon's point, if you want to critique us that maybe we should have done something in 10, 11, or 12, so be it. And we'll take that critique, but we won't take that critique and decide to do the same thing in 2023.
Martin, obviously the sustainability issues as it relates to the environment and resources is a huge thing looking forward. Do you believe that skill has also been diminished in the game as a result of distance, that elite golfers are being asked to showcase less than they might have been in previous generations?
I think skill is something that, you know, we've thought about a lot through this process. And I think you have to step through from the recreational game through to the elite game in answering that, Eamon. And I think if you look at the recreational game, the advent of improved technology, which we've seen for hundreds of years, but it's, you know, accelerated in the last 20, 30, 40 years. I think it's been a fantastic thing for the game. It's turned what is a difficult game into a slightly less difficult game. But when I look at that, I also think about the balance between skill and technology. And as you move up through that continuum, I think I argue that skill can be perhaps replaced by technology. And when you look at the integrity, when we talk about the integrity of the game, and we talk about the integrity of competition, it is that balance of skills from driving to mid-irons, to short irons, to chipping, to putting, that is about the integrity of the game, and that's about history. And our job is to reflect history in a modern way. And being able to get that balance right, I think, is really important to the long-term integrity. And I absolutely believe that this notice and comment will actually help us maintain that balance in skill and technology in the coming 20 years.
Martin, when you look at all the different stakeholders in the game of golf, obviously you have the governing bodies that have pushed this forward. If you talk with golf fans, I think it would be an extremely small minority that says the ball goes too far when they're enjoying looking at or watching a championship event. You also have equipment manufacturers, professionals, golf course operators, and architects. It seems like a very delicate balance that you have to navigate to push this forward without hampering the growth of the game going forward?
Yeah, I think one of the wonderful things about our sport is there is so many different constituents and partners and stakeholders in it. But, you know, Mike and I have talked about this a fair amount. And, you know, our responsibility as governing bodies is as custodians of the sport and the future of the sport. And, you know, governance isn't easy because we have to think out longer term. And we also have to have views on where the game is going, but not everybody's going to agree with. And, you know, I think if we end up with a situation here where half the people don't agree with us and half don't think we've done enough, we're in the right position as governing bodies. And we have to think forward and we have to have that integrity of long-term integrity of the game. And it's challenging and it's up to us to sell our case and make sure that we're preserving this fantastic game for future generations. The one thing I do think that is really important out of all of this and is that doing nothing is not responsible and not acceptable. We have to do something, and this is what we think is the best next step. And we will go through the next 6 months and listen and think as well as we go through that period.
Mike, as you mentioned earlier...
Hey, George, let me... Sorry, I mean, you know me, I'm always ready to add more to it. But I think... I just want to make sure that you know that neither Martin and I woke up this morning and said, wow, this is going to be a fun day. And this is what we live for. We know this is hard. You know, we don't enjoy being the one that pushes for making sure the future is in the right plot, in the right spot. And I certainly knew when I took this job a couple of years ago that governance is a challenging role. But I also, having been somebody who's worked at a manufacturer, somebody who's worked at a tour, and now worked at a governing body, I also understand the difference between sort of who I work for, whether it's membership or shareholders, consumers, et cetera. And the one thing that is true in spending this last couple of years with Martin and his team and my team is we really view that we work for the game, and that despite the difficulty and the challenges and sometimes the significant pushback, making sure that the game for my kids, or more importantly, my kids' kids, is healthier than the game that I'm enjoying right now, or at least as healthy, is something somebody's got to think about. And I can tell you, when I was sitting on those other roles, I just couldn't spend the time with that. My members or my shareholders were focused on today and tomorrow and this quarter results. And so it's an interesting spot to now come full circle and be in this position to really say that as difficult as it is, as much pushback as you're going to get, your job is to make sure that when you see things that could be problematic for the game long term. And to your point, George, I can't wait for the average fan to say, yeah, you're right, we're 30 yards longer today than we were 30 years ago. And we'll probably be 30 yards longer in 30 years, but that's okay. That's their job, is to enjoy the telecast and enjoy the game today. And we're going to do all we can to make sure we don't interrupt that. And at the same time, make sure that nonchalantness to 30 more yards and golf courses will just figure it out doesn't become a problem for the game.
Mike, to Martin's point about finding this balance between skill and technology and making sure that technology doesn't diminish the skill requirements asked, wouldn't that be something that would be tackled by addressing golf clubs and the forgiveness of golf clubs, which you've said in the statement is for now off the table? Is that something that's permanently off the table, or is that something you think potentially you look at down the road again?
As we pointed out a year ago, Eamon, we were looking at golf clubs that have a smaller sweet spot and a little less rebound off the face. As we got into, to move that significantly enough to have a real difference at the elite level, the club became so small that you would actually have to do fairway woods hybrids, and it became sort of not sustainable to think that the top players could be serviced at that level, that a local PGA or USGA or an R&A person could implement that at a local level, and maybe it was even cost prohibitive for the individual player. So for today, we took that off the table. The concept is still very much interesting to us, and even as we said in our notice and comment, even the way face rebound, if you will, starts to sometimes creep over time on current golf clubs is a concern and something we're going to take a deep look at. So I wouldn't say we're done looking at golf clubs, but I think in the current phase, we said what we talked about in the area of interest a year ago is not something we're pursuing at this moment. We're trying in this process to make sure that both the manufacturers and our stakeholders know exactly where we are, when we're there, and they have a chance to chime in on that exact situation. So it's a unique process that we're kind of sharing exactly where we are as we go. And when we move away from something, we feel a responsibility to share that, and that's what we did.
Martin, you mentioned the intent of the R&A to introduce this model local rule at a future Open Championship. How much do you drill down into that championship when you apply this? Does it go all the way down to local qualifying, where guys have to use that golf ball. And, you know, people who've qualified for it on other tours clearly won't have been using or might not have been using that golf ball to achieve the status that's getting them into the Open. How far does it go in terms of where the expectation is that this equipment would be played for the Open Championship?
I think it's a great question, which I don't have all the answers for at the moment. And it's certainly part of the work that we've now got to do over the next 6 months. And actually, they're probably a little bit longer. But, you know, I think that it is certainly not just elite tour golf and majors that I believe should be part of this model local rule. It does need to come down more into the elite amateur sport and maybe even to some of the club sport. But that is an option that we've now given the game. And it's an option that I think over the years to come will be an option that more may choose to adopt. But the detail in terms of how the qualifying is work in progress, and certainly a lot of thinking and still needs to be done.
Martin, I know golf fans will think of, okay, well, back in the day, there was a different ball that was used for the Open than what we saw over here with the U.S. Open and the PGA Tour. Any precedents to what we saw historically and how that was handled with what we're going to see going forward?
Well, I mean, I'm old enough to remember playing the smaller ball. I know quite a few of the players in the Open in those days would flip between smaller balls and the larger ball, the 1.68 American ball. But, you know, we introduced, you know, going back to the point about model local rules, there was a model local rule put back in the 60s around moving to the one ball. And that was to manage that small ball, larger ball dilemma that was going on. And, you know, I think that we've always had to manage that, and we always will manage that as we go forward.
Mike, if this model local rule is adopted, for instance, for USGA championships several years down the road, how difficult do you anticipate that would be to actually police once you move out of a US Open and suddenly you're talking about, for instance, the United States Amateur?
I think of all the different options we've looked at, Eamon, including all the different approaches we could take, this is by far the simplest. You're talking about a golf ball. So from a cost perspective, doable for the athlete, you're talking about something that we can handle from a conforming list and sharing with the tournament operators. So of all the different ways we could approach this, and at the same time, to Martin's original point, leave the recreational game alone, I can think of no option so far that we've reviewed that would be easier to implement than the one on the table. Now, you're all kind of thinking about in today's world, but 3 years from now and having different golf balls available. I mean, Martin talked about I'm old enough to remember playing a Bellotta ball, knowing that I was, you know, 10 yards shorter than some of my other friends, but I played it because I wanted the performance levels, but more importantly, I was going to play in events. So we've seen different variations of this. But, yeah, I think this is very executable at a local level. And quite frankly, this doesn't work if this is just about 40 tour stops or 40, you know, Korn Ferry stops or a few major stops. This has got to go into qualifying sites and state and local amateurs. I mean, long term, if we're really going to make sure that we can protect courses from having to continue to spend tens of millions of dollars every 10 years to keep up with the game, that we have to make sure this is about the high level of the game, not just one aspect of high level of the game.
Mike Martin, I know there are a lot of people who would like some of your time today to discuss the new proposed model local rule. We really appreciate you being so generous here on Golf Today.
Thanks for your help, guys.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having us.
Moving right along here on Golf Today. This statement from Acushnet. They said one of golf's unifying appeals is that everyone in the game plays by the same set of rules, can play the same courses and with the same equipment. Golfers can watch professionals and compare themselves to the world's best, aspiring to hit the same shots. The USGA and RNA have announced a notice and comment to manufacturers proposing a potential rule change to golf ball testing that results in a model local rule that provides for reduced distance golf balls intended for professional and elite amateur competitions and a different set of rules for all other play. This bifurcation would divide golf between elite and recreational play, add confusion, and break the linkage that is part of the game's enduring fabric. All right, we're just getting started on this jam-packed edition of Golf Today. This proposal will directly impact those in the PGA Tour. Let's hear from the guys teeing it up at this week's Valspar Championship. That's when we return on the other side of the break. Let's welcome in our reporter this week, Kira K. Dixon, covering the Valspar Championship. Kira, what's the player reaction been to this news?
Well, the news came out a little bit earlier this morning when a lot of players are either out on the course or practicing in the practice facility here. So a lot of folks are still really getting their arms around everything and educating themselves on the topic at hand. There are several USGA representatives that are out here as well, and they told me that their main goal today is just to listen to players, to provide as much information as possible. And they said that the main points for them is reiterating to players that this is really a down-the-line issue, that they're trying to preserve the game 25 years from now, 50 years from now, and reiterating that this is an option for the PGA Tour to pursue, while the USGA will most likely be implementing this for the 2026 US Open. Now, is this something the PGA Tour will pursue? There's been a spectrum of responses to that, everything from fairly positive to fairly negative. One player told me that fans want to come out here and see us hit the ball as far as possible. We want to be as athletic as possible with the golf ball. Not being able to do that to this player impacts the product, impacts then the charities that they support. And he said, you know, who cares if we shoot 30 under? But it really seems that this is a wait and see situation. But one thing that is for certain is there is going to be a wide array of opinions moving forward.
You know, I know the USGA and RNA have been, you know, very united in that they don't like bifurcation, they don't want bifurcation. I think golf as a whole, PGA Tour players included, it is nice to have the same rules for pros and amateurs. And when we go play, we're here at Valspar, guys and fans come watch us, they know that they're watching a sport that they play by the same rules, same equipment, which I think is really nice. I think the USGA has done a great job in kind of forward thinking, and, you know, distance could be a problem if we don't look at it the right way. I personally believe that I don't know that we need to roll back equipment. I think there needs to be more emphasis on golf course design. You know, I've said for a long time, we got to learn from the greats, and Pete Dye was a great. 4 and 6 last week at TPC Sawgrass were 390 yards and 385 yards, I believe, and they both played over par for the week. So you have the best players in the world on holes that are under 400 yards, and they play over par. And I think golf course design and architecture needs to be looked at harder in these conversations. Now, specifically to this proposal, had a great conversation with Scott Langley this morning from USGA. Scott's been great. He wants to simply hear from the players. He's listening. He wants to know what we think. And like he said, it is a proposal. It's not going to definitely be in effect for us. But Kira, I think the problem is if the PGA Tour doesn't go along with this proposal, and we continue to do what we're doing, but yet 4 majors throughout the year put this into play, then manufacturers have a problem, we have a problem, and I just don't know if that's good for the game of golf. I think all of us like to hit the ball far, but we've been around long enough to know that there's certain courses there needs to be change, and I think most guys don't necessarily think it's the driver of the ball. We want to see tighter fairways. We want to see more rough. We want to see more trees, kind of dog legs and stuff like that. That seems to be pretty popular among the guys that I've talked to.
So not to distill everything that you've said, but it seems like it comes down to design and architecture for you as opposed to really focusing on the equipment.
Yeah, that's not going to fix the distance problem. I want to be clear there. But I feel like I told Scott it needs to be in the conversation. I feel like there are certain golf courses we play where there's genius that needs to be paid attention to that will help this problem that we're seeing. And I just think that needs to be a main piece of the pie for this whole distance thing. I think the USGA, they need to highlight the US Open. Like, that needs to be the focus, not golf ball, driver, how far we're hitting that. But, like, keep the focus on the US Open, the championship that has so much rich history. And I feel like if they do that, that's going to be a problem that they encounter that week, where that's what media is talking about, that's what all the players are trying to figure out, not the golf course and how to play it, but their equipment. And I don't know if they want that.
I think it kind of was a long time coming. you know, these golf balls nowadays, technology's so good, right? Manufacturers did everything they could to make sure the golf ball goes straight and far, right? So I think it's going to create a lot of a lot more imagination, a lot more creativity that used to be in the game, instead of just kind of hit it off far and straight. So I'm really excited for it. You know, it's funny, I was thinking about it, and I haven't played a golf ball that, you know, was like what they're going to end up going to in quite some time, right? So, you know, I'm sure they're going to do a bunch of testing and stuff before, and probably give us a little time to kind of adjust to it. But I'm really looking forward to seeing shot shapes again, like you used to see, right? Like a shot, for example, like a rising ball flight. You know, you don't see that anymore because of the ball technology. So you're going to see a little bit more of that come back, which is really cool. But again, I don't know exactly how far they're going to go with this, but it's going to be a really exciting change, I think, and I think it's going to make the game a little bit better.
So Brandon Matthews, who you just heard from at the end, is really interesting because he is second in overall driving distance on the PGA Tour behind only Rory McIlroy. So this is something that could potentially cause him to lose a significant advantage out on the PGA Tour when it comes to carrying significant obstacles. But he maintains he thinks that this is an exciting change, and he feels that beyond just solving the distance problem, it could lead to a more complete test of the game.
Fascinating guy to get some insight with, considering, like you said, he's second on the PGA Tour in driving distance. And if we're looking at some of the key distance metrics when it comes to the PGA Tour, average carry distance back in 2007, 15 plus years ago, 265.7. That's increased 17 yards now to 282.9. Clubhead speed has only jumped 2 miles an hour, not crazy, 2.2. In those 15 years, number of golfers with 120 plus mile an hour clubhead speed was 9 in 2007, up to 22 now. Official data on the PGA Tour has been collected dating back to 2007. And it's now three guys on the desk as we welcome in our pal here, Jaime Diaz. Jaime, the day has come. We've been talking about this for quite some time. Your thoughts on the proposed model local rule?
You know, it's interesting how it's by opponents translated directly as bifurcation, but it is part of the rules of golf. It's not a separate set of rules. Local rule is in the rules of golf right now. So
does it feel like bifurcation?
No, well, it's obviously de facto bifurcation, but it's still playing by the same rules. Now, I don't want to, you know, it's semantics.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very skillful use of something that actually solves a problem, in my opinion. In terms of what Martin Slumbers, who I think gets the heart of it in terms of the elite game, this is about restoring skill. This is about restoring challenge at the very highest level and basically following history, as he said. And his role, he believes, is to follow history and present history in a modern way. And it's a continuum. And I think the challenge that they're trying to restore is the one that we saw in the golden age of golf, so to speak. I'm not to say that we're not in a golden age right now, just to say that There were long irons in guys' hands coming into par fours. There were really tight fairways that were hard to hit with a spinny golf ball and a wooden club. And the game, as he said, with technology, has gotten slightly easier. Now, can you start making it to the point where technology starts to compromise skill? And I think that's the balance they're trying to hit. I think it's an honorable balance. I think it's a good discussion. This is an endless topic. We've talked about it for 5 years, and we'll continue to. It's really a rich topic. But I think the USGA and the RNA have their heart in the right place. They're trying to improve the game. You can disagree, but I don't think they have an agenda beyond that.
Amon, a quick follow, if you don't mind. Jaime, you look at the data shared, and for top hitter on the PGA Tour, I think it would be about 17 and 19-yard rollback. Mid-hitter, I think it's like 15 yards. So if you work your way through a guy's bag, it's maybe a half a club to a club difference with the irons. Is that really restoring skill, or is it just proportionally shifting it back a little so we don't run out of real estate with some of these golf courses and properties?
I think that's a big part of it, but I think we all know that the razor's edge of incremental differences between players is so small that these things matter too. I mean, right now, there's a lot of wedges being hit into par fours. You roll it back 20 yards, and now you got 8 irons and 9 irons, perhaps. And that makes a difference, I think. I think pretty much everybody's pretty good with a wedge, or at least they're going to hit the green. Now, there's some that are artists, like Justin Thomas and Dustin Johnson made himself one. And that's an art, too, and that's skill, too. I'm not trying to say that a wedge is an easy shot. I'm just simply saying that through the bag, the game gets slightly more challenging. And I think that's good for the pro game. Now, I understand people want to see the long ball. I get it. And fans have to be followed. And golf has become more of an entertainment, certainly with the infusion of LIV right now. You know, they don't want to differentiate themselves and look like they're going backwards. And LIV would, of course, would use that as an opportunity to say, oh, no, we're the progressive game with all the bells and whistles. So it's very delicate right now. But, again, I go back to I trust these guys for looking at the game as a whole in the future, healthy, and doing the best thing for it. And I think they're the group, the RNA and the USGA, that have the credibility to do that. I don't think they are trying to do anything else. I mean, they're taking shots. It's not like they're gaining power. I think they would lose credibility if they didn't try to do something.
It remains to be seen, I guess, if this is the result of a negotiation or the start of a negotiation, because this process really did start with a Distance Insights report 3 years ago. That was the first shot in this war. I'm inclined to think that while various bodies are making these statements about how we're going to work with them, we're going to continue with this feedback process, this war is over, I think. This is going to happen. The question is whether or not the elite tours choose to adopt it. And that becomes a very delicate issue because at the very least in 2026, I'm willing to bet that three of the four major championships will have a modified golf ball. The PGA Championship, potential outlier. They did put out a statement this morning saying they're happy that nothing is being done with a recreational game. As far as the PGA Championship goes, they'll address that down the road whenever more information becomes clear. But we could have this kind of break where the major championships are deemed to be the ultimate test of skill in this game. And then you have the PGA Tour, if it doesn't fall in line and adopt this, does it get diminished as merely an entertainment product? And those are tough decisions that various people and organizations are going to have to make going forward.
Well, they both have something to lose. I mean, if the PGA Tour and the tours in general don't follow the model local rule, that hurts the USGA, certainly. It makes them look like they have less authority. On the other hand, if they don't follow, they also look like outliers who are not doing things for the best interest of the game and looking like they're just profiteers. So I think that tug of war will be an interesting one. It hasn't been settled. I think there will be compromises. This 127 is a number, I think, that's a negotiable number.
But ultimately, what this comes down to is, does this game bend its parameters to the commercial objectives to various organizations or companies who work within that game? You've got to separate at some point the product from the broader sport. And that's a hard definition to draw for a lot of
people. I see it as art versus commerce. You know, I'm sort of a romantic about the game, I guess, and maybe it's a weakness, but right now commerce is very prominent in the game because of the challenge of LIV. And so it's an awkward time to be asking for something that's about aesthetics, actually. You know, what kind of game do you want to see? And, you know, I like the game that's all the clubs in the bag. Some people just like hit that driver as far as you can, and spin that wedge in there. And that's okay, too. I don't know which is better. I have my preference, and I think the USGA has a preference that they think fosters skill.
It's kind of an odd position for the PGA Tour to be in, because you look at the NFL, NBA, MLB. They're the organization, and they dictate what rules they play by. The PGA Tour has to try and play in the same sandbox as what the edicts are from the governing bodies with the RNA and the USGA. They don't have, to this point, they haven't broken away or have complete autonomy over how they're going to play compared to how USGA championships or RNA championships are contested.
They've always had the option to make their own rules. They've always deferred to the USGA and the RNA. They would rather those guys have that hard job.
And all of these statements we're seeing are people who are opposed to the idea of bifurcation. That's what they're hanging their hat on right now, is we want it to be bifurcated. If they suddenly choose to decide, well, we're not going to go down this road with you, that's kind of like saying, you know, I love your democracy as long as I like the results of the election. Sure. But we'll bifurcate from governance if we don't like it.
Let's get to another one of those statements. You had mentioned what the PGA of America had to share. Here it is in totality. As we previously stated to the USGA and the RNA, we are strongly opposed to any rule changes that make the game less fun for recreational golfers. Regarding this specific area of interest, we are pleased that there is no longer a focus on changing or modifying the ball or clubs that recreational players may use. We are not in favor of bifurcation and do not anticipate individual clubs implement such a model local rule as it is meant for elite players. In regards to the PGA Championship, 2026, still a long way off until we know the specifics of the proposed model local rule. We are not in a position to make that determination. That from the PGA of America. still have more reaction to come, with the USGA and RNA proposing that model local rule which would roll back the ball for elite competitions in 2026. Golf Channel's Matt Adams stopping on the show now. Matt, would love to get your take on the news today.
I thought, in general, I think that Eamon had it right with this, the first question to golf's governing bodies to suggest, to say, hey, if restrictions on technology is a horse that's been let out of the barn, I mean, they clearly, these organizations are the ones that open the door. So that's step one. So I think it's good, because otherwise this debate starts to become somehow about how the elite players, PGA Tour players, if you please, are somehow guilty of being PGA Tour players. They're better trained than they've ever been. They're better fit than they've ever been. The conditions of the golf course better than they've ever been. And the technology is better than it's ever been. However, having said all that, for me personally, I support what the USGA and the RNA are trying to do, because they're looking forward, right? 50 years from now, if we had the same advancements in yardage off the tees as we've had over at least the last two decades, maybe three, cast that forward another 20, 30 years into the future, and we would definitely be having a problem. So a speed bump was very necessary in the game of golf. I think in this case, though, the proposal that they made, I'm a little bit more aligned to what Jaime was saying earlier. I still have a sense that the war isn't over, Eamon, that I think this is a starting point in terms of the speed that the robot's being jacked up to. Currently, the average swing speed on the PGA Tour is about 115 miles per hour. They test at 120. There's only 22 players on the PGA Tour that even can crest that level. They're now going to move it by proposal up to 127 miles per hour. In doing so, they'd bring the speed the distance average on the PGA Tour down to about 282.9 yards. That'd be a loss of 16.1 yards on average. The thing that you run into, though, and this is what people don't understand necessarily, is that it is disproportionate. The faster your swing speed, the more that you can impact and affect the suite of technology that is in the modern golf clubs and ball in union, then the less you're going to be impacted. So if you have players that are under the current average swing speed threshold in the PGA Tour, they're going to be disproportionately impacted by this proposal. I'll give you an example. Colin Morikawa has a 113 miles per hour swing speed. He would lose 18.4 yards. He'd be brought down to 277. At the low end of the spectrum, someone like Joel Damon, who's at 110 swing speed, that's miles per hour. I keep saying yards, but it's miles per hour. He would lose 28 yards, meaning that he'd be down to about 263 yards, which would put him roughly in the average that was about 1995. So while I like the direction that they're going for the reasons that it's good for the game, I think that they're going at it a little too hard on the front end. And I hope as this discussion period, as they say, is going to continue over the coming days, weeks, and months, that that's one of the things that they take a look at. I would much rather have seen them bring it in a ratcheted way, maybe a 1 mile per hour per year for a while. Then you wouldn't have had to change anything. There isn't anybody that would have complained if they said, hey, for the good of the game, you might lose 2.3 yards. Everyone would shrug their shoulders and go, okay, I can't tell that anyway. The other thing which I wish they had done instead was I wish they had put more spin back into the golf ball. So if you really are looking for skill, as Martin Slummers was talking about, because I find it hard to not talk about skill when you're talking about players that have reached an elite level around the world, they obviously have skill. But if they had a little bit more spin in the golf ball, that would impact not only distance, but it would also illustrate those that are the best ball strikers.
Well, Matt, if we're going to talk about not having this sort of blanket rollback for everyone and try to figure out how to better differentiate the skills on the PGA Tour, is that not an argument that the USGA and RNA have not gone far enough, that they should have actually tackled driver faces as well?
Well, the thing is, though, Eamon, it's not just not that I disagree with you that they should have attacked driver faces. And if you look at their press release, they said they're not altering the standards of equipment at this time, underscore that. However, what people don't understand is that as we're discussing the impact of the rollback of technology on the golf ball, we keep talking about it in terms of what it's doing off the tee, as though it ends there. That percentage impact is going to impact every club in iron that the players hit throughout the entirety of the bag. So again, my whole message here today is that while I approve and personally the direction that they're going, the impact on what they're proposing right now is really far more severe than what we think it is in terms of just looking at average driving distances. You have to look at the entirety of the impact on players. So in a sense, every piece of technology in a player's bag is going to be impacted because of what's happening here.
Matt, you have your hand on the heartbeat of the equipment industry. It seems like the stock answer for most equipment companies, given that they're coming off record revenues post-COVID, would be for the status quo. What tangible impact do you think it would have starting in 2026 with this model local rule if they had to then market a reduced ball for the pros and then other balls for the masses?
Well, it's a good question, George, because the first thing for people to understand is why would an equipment manufacturer be against a so-called bifurcation, or as Martin Slumberg called it, a split model? The reason why is that they know that John Q. Public golfer sitting at home, he wants to hit the golf ball that he saw Scottie Scheffler playing this week, because golf is such an aspirational game and there is so much hope embedded in every single sale. You've got people that are going to go out and say, hey, if I hit that ball, I'm going to be able to hit it as far as him or spin it as much as him or hit it as well as he does. That's the nature of the game. But if you have a distinctive ball that says this is for an elite player and this is for everybody else, the manufacturer is going to be worried, how does that give us distinction in the marketplace? I get that it is marketing on their part. I understand that approach. I still think that there could have been a way to do this, or maybe there will be through this period, where you have a golf ball that it's recognized as the top golf ball in the industry. It's just this golf ball over here is more for an elite player, meaning that you're not going to get the same distance as you're going to get with this particular model that still otherwise is the exact same family. Like Dominic Chu was talking about earlier, that some of the manufacturers are upset, saying it's going to mean new tooling, it's going to be very expensive to do it. It really isn't that hard for the manufacturers to alter the formula for the core so that they have a golf ball that suits different demographics while still keeping it in, for example, say a premium family. So I do think that there's a way around that. I think the vehement positions of companies that are against this idea of two is more based on marketing than it is based on practicality.
Matt, this whole process seems to have been set up to kind of diffuse confrontation. You know, it's been going on for several years. We've had multiple feedback periods in which every constituency in the game was asked for their view on it, including equipment companies and players and recreational golfers as well. Is this debate too much framed by the commercial objectives of equipment companies?
It always is. And the reason why, I believe that's the reason, in my personal opinion, why it's coming out as a model local rule instead of just a hard and fast rule. The governing bodies want to make sure that they don't get themselves in a position like they had with Ping 30 years ago, where there's massive lawsuits running around and there's people trying to protect their particular positions. At the same time, we go back to the same thing that we started this whole conversation with, and that you asked the governing bodies for. You said, wait a minute, if there's a problem here with equipment, I'm paraphrasing, isn't that first your problem of allowing that problem to happen? And you know, Mike Wan said, if you want that to be the headline, that's okay. Well, that's the truth. So the truth is that these are the governing bodies that are supposed to be governing equipment technology. And if it has gotten to a point where it is too far, they share part of that responsibility. So they're trying to bring in what they call all these stakeholders to make sure that all of these companies have a say. I still happen to believe that there's a pathway that they can find that takes care of the concerns of the manufacturing companies, as well as the concerns of the game, and providing a speed bump to slow down the advancements in distance. I just don't think you have to put up a massive wall immediately right on the front end. That's why I tend to think that Jaime might have it right, that this might not be an ending point. It might be a starting point for a new conversation.
Matt, while it's the first time we're talking with you about this model local rule, I'm sure it won't be the last time. We're going to see you again real soon.
Thanks, guys.
The PGA Tour has reached the final stop of the Florida Swing this week, the Valspar Championship at Innisbrook. Sam Burns, the only player to win this event so far this decade, winning it the last 2 years. Two of his four wins on the PGA Tour. This will mark the end of the tour's four-week residency in the Sunshine State. Let's head back out to Palm Harbor, Florida. Check in once again with Kira K. Dixon, who's out at covering the Valspar Championship. You had some player reaction the first hour. What more are you hearing in regards to this proposed model local rule?
Well, George, I just spoke with one player that told me, frankly, I don't care. I'm out here earning a very comfortable living. If they tell me to use a specific golf ball to continue to be able to do that, then that's fine with me. I will play whatever golf ball the powers that be deem is the correct golf ball. Others so far have had a more visceral reaction, saying that this would be unfortunate for the PGA Tour's product, especially considering where we are in the landscape right now, and that they need to do everything they can to maintain excitement around the game and to bring as many eyeballs as possible to the game. And they think that rolling back the golf ball could potentially hinder that. Another question that's been floating around the range is, if all of the majors adopt this, would it be odd for the PGA Tour to not adopt it as well? Well, when I spoke with Webb Simpson earlier, he said that he thinks that the PGA Tour would ultimately adopt this if this proposal ends up going through. And Harry Higgs, who I spoke with just a little while ago, agreed with that sentiment as well and gave his overall insight into this possibility.
My immediate reaction was, get off my lawn, leave us alone. We're doing, having a huge effort to sell and get people to watch us play golf, get people to, invest in the game. And this initially seems as it would make it maybe slightly more difficult to do that. And then also the thought that now for the first time, if and when these are implicated, that the game will be different for me than versus, my dad, let's say, who's a 15 handicap. And that's something that golf has always had. And I think there is an inherent value in that you can use the same clubs that I use. You can play the same golf courses that I play. And, come tomorrow, I'm going to be playing nine holes in a pro-am group with guys, on the golf course that I'm going to be playing this week. There is a huge value in that. There's no pro-ams in basketball, let's say, and they wouldn't really be that much fun because those guys are vastly, vastly more athletic and just better at what they do. So the initial thought is definitely jokingly, get off my lawn, leave us alone. And I would imagine there will be some heated debates about whether or not we are going to implement this. And I would, if I could forecast ahead to 2026, I think we will be implementing this. And I understand the reasons why, and it's reasons that are less on the competitive side and more on the sustainability side. As the game gets longer and longer and longer and guys become more athletic and more well-trained to hit the ball longer and be able to do that year in and year out, you could see in 10, 15 years a U.S. Open golf course have to be, 9,000 yards for it to be for it to achieve kind of what it has achieved in the past in terms of being a great test, usually a winner around even par. And that's probably not a great thing. So we got a whole lot of wait and see. This is obviously day one. I would imagine there's going to be plenty of heated debate. And then just probably, I would assume, some consideration on our end. Do we implement this in regular PGA Tour stops, or do we just basically use a different golf ball in majors? I would be shocked if that's what we actually end up doing, because that just sounds silly to me. But I guess just kind of a whole lot of wait and see. The initial thought is definitely, leave us alone. Like, game's hard enough as it is. And there are ways to make golf courses harder that I think people forget, rather than having the rough be really long and it be really, and the golf course also be really long, adding new tee boxes and the like. Doesn't always make it a whole lot more difficult on us.
I asked Harry if he thinks that any sort of bifurcation is important in the game right now, whether it's golf balls, equipment, both. And he said that he really doesn't think it's necessary. Although, like he mentioned in the sound, this is just day one. He is open to learning more and possibly changing that opinion down the line, but he did laugh and said, interesting times in the game of golf. And he left it with this, that in his opinion, folks at golf tournaments surround tee boxes more so than they do the fairways or the greens, and that no matter what happens with the golf ball, he doesn't see at least that changing anytime soon.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some merit to that as we look at how the average carry distance on the PGA Tour has evolved over the years. 2007, 265.7. Big jump from 2007 to 2012. Nearly 9 yards. The increase from 2012 to 2017, just under 4 yards. And from 2017 to 2022, 4.5 yards. So it's up to 282.9. It's the most recent carry distance on the PGA Tour.
Well, coming up next, we're going global. In this distance debate, we'll be joined by one of the most prominent voices on the issue, Mike Clayton, an elite player turned respected architect. He's going to join us from Australia. Coming up next. Well, for many years, one of the most thoughtful voices on this topic has been Mike Clayton. He won on the European and Australasian tours, and now works as a golf course architect. And Mike is kind enough to join us from his home outside of Melbourne in the middle of the night, Australia time. Mike, thanks for joining us. What's your initial reaction to the news you hear today from the USGA and the RNA?
Well, welcome, except that 317 yards sounds like an awful lot. This was a problem identified by Nicklaus, amongst others, 20 years ago when the ball was going way less than that. So it's a start. It's a start, but only a start. And clearly, they're not going to go under that. But 317 yards off the tee still, it sort of diminishes most of the great golf courses around the world in terms of how their architects wanted them to play and how they saw them playing. Whilst we're never going to go back to the days of 480 yard holes that were drives and fairway woods, at 317 yards, they're still only drives and short irons. And for me, part of the problem is that this is such an American-centric debate, centered around American golf courses, where there's so many golf courses around the world, like Royal Melbourne, one of the greatest courses in the world, that doesn't have any more room to expand. And it's 7,000 yards, a composite course, which is really to test the best players in the world. As we saw at the President's Cup, is way too short. Yeah, it's one of the great golf courses. We saw Tiger Woods at the President's Cup play the best golf of anyone of the 24 players there. And he played that course brilliantly, but it was still, if Alex McKenzie had come back and watched that golf, he'd have been shocked at how that course played versus how he'd wanted it to play and how he'd have seen it playing in 1926. Not that we're ever going back there, but when I saw Hale Irwin and Ballesteros play that course in the late 70s, it was pretty much perfect.
Michael, you have the unique lens of obviously having been a professional on the Australasian Tour and the DP World Tour and now a golf course architect. How do you balance, from an architectural standpoint, being constrained when it comes to real estate with also commercial interest in the game, what fans want to see, what pros around the world would like? If you say the top end of the spectrum, the rollback would be 17 to 19 yards. For mid-pros, it's 14 to 15. If that's not enough, what would you like to see then?
Well, I'd like to see the days when a 480-yard par 4 was a drive and a 3-iron. I want to see pros hitting long and middle irons into long par 4s. And how do you, as an architect, how do you build a par 4 that for the best players, you know that they're going to be hitting 3, 4, 5, and 6 irons into the greens? I mean, you know, Mike DeVries and I are building a course down here in Hobart, and we joke that, well, what sort of wedge is this hole going to be? So, you know, and then you say, what do the fans want? Well, you know, I adored watching golf when Hale Irwin was playing Royal Melbourne in the late 70s, hitting 4 and 5 irons to the green. I thought he put on a masterful performance winning the Australian PGA, hitting long clubs into the green. You know, is it really golf dumbed down to the point where all fans want to see is the pros smashing the ball 340 yards. So, you know, I would much rather see, and I think everyone would want to see a much wider test of their skills. And they want to see architects being able to build holes that can test, par fours that can test drives and mid and long irons. And certainly the reality of the game in Australia you know, I've caddied this year on the Australian Tour for a young kid here for, you know, 6 or 7 weeks. The vast majority of clubs he's hit into the par fours are drives and wedges. And it's fine for Americans to argue that, well, you know, that's not, you know, the stats don't back that up. But I've got yardage books that'll show you that 90% of the clubs he's hit into par fours are with wedges or nine irons. So, you know, it's not just about defending American courses, but defending courses all around the world. But because the manufacturers are so centered in America, and because the vast majority of pro golf's played in America, and because it's, you know, it's such a powerful country in the world, it's, you know, it's become such an American-centric debate. And it needs to, you know, we need to be discussing how this affects golf courses all around the world, in South Africa, New Zealand, Asia, Australia, Europe, Britain. So, you know, it's a tricky question, but, I mean, do people really need to be hitting the ball 320 yards to test who the best player in the game is? And the other crazy thing, you know, bringing in Royal Melbourne, you know, I see, you know, people say, well, just grow the rough longer. Well, you destroy the essence of what Mackenzie built there and what he built at Augusta. You know, that those courses were predicated around having space to play off the tee. And depending on which part of the fairway you drove, it depended on what sort of second shot you got. And, you know, if you narrow the fairways, it just becomes a test of straight hitting. And the best golf in the world at the old course at Augusta, at Royal Melbourne, and courses like that, they're not tests of straight hitting. They're tests of thought and execution, as opposed to simply just asking players to hit the ball straight down narrow fairways bordered with high grass. And that's the most boring version of the game, I think, and always has been. And it wasn't the way the greatest architects of the early part of the 20th century thought the game should be played. And you can say, well, you're stuck in the past, but, you know, you look at the amazing golf courses those guys built that have really stood the test of time, except until the latest era when, you know, their longest and most difficult par fours are reduced to drives and short irons. And to me, it's never made any sense. It makes no sense. And it's time that, well, it was certainly beyond time that the administration did something about it. Whether that's enough or not, I guess we'll see.
Michael, we were looking forward to the conversation. Appreciate you burning the midnight oil on your end to spend some time with us here on Golf Today.
No problem. Thanks, George. Thanks, Eamon.